Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fix It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. at George Middle School in Portland. The Fix It Fair helps you learn simple ways to save money and connect with resources. Join your neighbors and talk to the experts about how to spend less and stay healthy. There will be exhibits and hourly workshops on water and energy savings, food and nutrition, neighborhood and community resources, weatherizing your home, transportation, a repair cafe, and much more, with childcare and lunch provided. Again, that's the Fix It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at George Middle School, 10,000 North Burr Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thirsty City, a monthly beat and rap night at The Know in Portland. On Saturday, January 27th, Thirsty City hosts the launch party for their new label and cassette release featuring 29 beat instrumentalists from Portland and Munich. The release party also features live sets by Bri Zen, 2 North, and more. Again, that's Thirsty City at The Know, 3728 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight I'll be airing audio from a performance called Shaping a Future, Life After Prison. Shaping a Future took place on October 29th, 2017 at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. This performance was free, open to the public, and the culmination of a series of writing workshops organized by Carolee Mani and funded by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Shaping a Future included monologues written and read by 9 individuals who had spent time in prison. They told stories of redemption and determination related to the reentry to society after prison. They also highlighted the failings of our criminal justice system. Tonight is part 3, and it includes the 3rd and 6th monologues by Joseph and James. This performance is being broadcast on KBOO Community Radio in segments over the next few months. We'll start tonight's show with Joseph's monologue, I Want You to Imagine This.
I remember getting out of Oregon State Penitentiary and taking some deep breaths. I don't know if you realize, but freedom has a smell, a crisp, refreshing smell. I remember the excitement as my mom, my sister, and my grandma were standing there waiting for me. I was carrying bags full of property, walking up to my family and giving them hugs. I remember the sense of overwhelming freedom, knowing that I had survived a nightmare. I don't even know how to describe it to you, but I knew then that I never wanted to go back to prison, not ever. My recovery is based on the fact that I refuse to go to prison ever again. I don't want to spend another second in prison. I'm not sure people understand the mental issues that come from years of incarceration. I didn't even believe in it, in mental health, until this last prison trip. I would watch all these guys in prison talk about things like voices in their heads, the anxiety of being around crowds of people, and depression. But I did experience firsthand the challenges of solitary confinement. In Oregon prisons, there is a program called intensive management, which is a type of solitary confinement. Somewhere it was decided that it was a good idea to put people in lockdown for 24 hours a day, take away everything away from them, and force feed them packets about thinking and behavior errors. They forgot that maybe a teacher or a mentor would be helpful in moving people in the right direction. Instead, they just throw these packets at you and they expect you to read them and learn on your own. I was fortunate enough to know how to read and write and comprehend, but not everyone could. For months on end, I was forced to live in a rectangle about 8 feet wide, 9 feet long, and a ceiling just out of reach. Day after day, sometimes night after night, I listened to the guys in the cells around me screaming their lungs out, banging their cups, and tapping their toothbrushes on my walls, trying to make sure I could never sleep, playing this mental warfare game, because some of them were mad or upset or hurt. I remember when I got out of prison, the cars would make so much noise, zoom! The noises were so intense and loud, the colors so vivid and bright, they were like enhanced by steroids. When we got into town, my sister, she took me to shopping. I walked into Burlington Coat Factory and people were everywhere. I mean, all around me. And my hands started to sweat. My heart started to beat. My senses were on full alert as an overwhelming feeling of panic and paranoia set in. My sister said, "Men's clothes are that way. Go grab some pants and a couple shirts." I looked at her if she was crazy, and I tried to force myself to concentrate. Shoot, I didn't even know what size pants I wore anymore. I mean, for so long, my pants choices were small, medium, or large, washed, and dried, and delivered to my door 3 times a week. Then she told me to go get a belt. I somehow found the belt rack. I got lost in the names and the sizes and colors, but I remember her yelling over, "Just pick one!" It's funny to me now, but in prison, our items are wrote down on a piece of paper and sent into commissary and delivered to us. I did so much solitary confinement that it messed with my head, with my brain. I didn't know how to act around people, and I wasn't able to feel comfortable in public places, let alone my own skin. They don't tell you that they will be caging you up like an animal and taking away all human contact, except for those on your tier. They don't tell you about the dysfunctional correctional officers that treat you like you don't matter. I once heard a correctional officer telling a guy a couple cells down that he was worthless and that he should take a sheet, wrap it tightly around his neck, do the world a favor, and kill himself. But all life, these are the people the community entrusts with lives that matter. But all lives matter, even the ones in prison. They consider us the incurables because they think there is no hope for us. But I am here to tell you there is hope. I stand in front of you with over 5 years clean, a man in recovery, a man in long-term recovery. I set goals and I accomplished them. I continue becoming a productive member of society. I'm a certified recovery mentor for a company that works with men and women in the criminal justice system. My company believes that recovery is a solution and there is hope for people condemned as statistics. I work with people that have the opportunity to get on their feet and learn to not use drugs or alcohol and become stable in society. Most of these people don't even know what recovery is, and I get to be a part of their process, whatever that looks like. Some of these people are living on the streets, chasing their tails, talking to themselves like zombies, looking for their next fix. I get to play a role in these individuals coming back to life. I didn't understand what my life was going to look like when I got out of prison. I used to lay there with my head on my pillow, staring at the wall and the ceiling, listening to people yelling and screaming because they had given up hope. I would dream of what my next steps would look like once I stepped out that gate. I found hope in building good habits. I started reading the Narcotics Anonymous books and different beliefs about God. I started working out on a regular basis, and I found a bunch of friends in it too. During one of my trips to intensive management unit, I found a vent in the back of my cell. I mustered up the courage one night, stepping up to my cold metal toilet. "Hello," I yelled. Surprisingly, after a few couple attempts, someone answered back. Truthfully, I didn't know if it was the man in the cell underneath me or if it was God finding me in the deepest, darkest times of my life because I was desperate for a friend. Day after day, night after night, I spoke to that person through the vent, and we even conducted 12-step meetings, each of us standing on our toilets, reading the AA big books while drinking coffee. That gave me hope and the drive to not quit. So if I can tell you one thing, it's that there's hope in the darkest places, but it takes us to be the light. We need to shine that light on others by saying that we believe in them. When was the last time someone said to you, "Hey, I believe in you, and I know you can do something with yourself"? I am doing something with myself. I continue moving forward. I don't know what 5 years will look like. I don't know what 10 years down the road will look like. But I know I need to keep doing what I am doing today, going to meetings, building relationships with people that aren't zombies, who are doing something with their lives. And that's what gives me the fighting chance. They say if you want to know where you'll be at in 5 years, look at the people you surround yourself with. The people you surround yourself with. If you hang out with knuckleheads, you're going to be a knucklehead. So I stopped hanging out with knuckleheads. For so long, what I thought I knew got me in trouble. So I have had to learn how to be open-minded to what life can teach me, what the people around me can teach me. One reason I stay sober is because my mom, she calls me. She says, "Joseph, will you give me a ride to the store tomorrow? I just need to grab 5 things. "Oh, sure, 5 things. I roll my eyes. And instead, she fills the shopping cart full, and it takes over an hour and a half. I laugh about that and sometimes act frustrated, but honestly, I look forward to every moment of it. It's a blessing to be a part of my family today, a blessing to be there for my sister and my grandma, who we call Granny Goose. I grew up in the middle class, and truthfully, I can't even say that. My family struggled to survive. My mom had 2 jobs, and my stepdad was a roofer who sold pot to make a couple extra bucks. My father died in California prison when I was 13 years old. And even though my family was middle class, I grew up in a house of addicts. I remember sitting in my mother's house, slaying, tossing drugs out the window with my sister at our customers. Shoot, mom was getting high back then too. I chose to run away around the same time my father died and started running the streets. I got arrested for the first time at the age of 16. Went to prison for my first trip at 19. I'm 33 years old and I've done over 7 years in prison and a couple years here and there in county jail. That's over a third of my life spent inside. The amends I owe my community are immense. No words can ever repay the families I hurt through my criminality. I hope my actions will forever be my living amends. What did it take for me to change my ways? Well, I had to get sick and tired of being sick and tired. But when that happened and I was finally ready, I had a tribe there for me with open arms, my recovery tribe. To accept me for all my mistakes, lift me up, dust me off, and give me room to grow and succeed. So although some of us did numerous years in prison and institutions, please don't count us out. We're part of your communities. We're your neighbors, your co-workers, and we want to be your friends. We want you to be able to depend on us, to count on us, to follow through with our word. We're parents, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, and cousins. We're just like you, except that we chose different paths growing up, some not by choice. I've been lucky because I didn't die like my father did. I didn't overdose like my friend did about 6 months ago. I haven't had to do a life sentence, and I still have some marbles, so I count my blessings. When you leave here today, the next time you see someone standing on the corner, don't just look away, but think, you know, that person can be someone. I'm not saying break bread with him and give him every dollar in your pocket, but give him a little smile, a little nod, and tell him that you believe in him. Because hearing that from the right person at the right moment can make you believe in yourself. And sometimes it's hearing it over and over and over and over that finally makes it click. And do believe in us. And don't let a bad apple ruin the whole tree. I believe in you. I believe that you are good-hearted people because you came here today to listen to us. And I couldn't have done any of this without the help of those that believed in me. So let's believe in one another. Thank you for coming to listen to us today.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. You just heard I Want You to Imagine This, written by Joseph and read during Shaping a Future, Life After Prison. Now we'll hear James's monologue, Healing the Split.
Growing up, I never knew my parents. I was raised by my grandparents until 7 years old, when my grandmother passed away. I have two older brothers, Keith and Sean. At that time, we were placed in separate group homes. I was in a younger facility due to my age. I would see them from time to time during outings or when our families came to visit. We were separated for about a year and a half. We were all then placed in a foster home with a single mother who had two children of her own, Rick and Tomiko. Adjusting to these changes was difficult for me. I was confused, afraid. I felt unwanted and depressed. This came out in aggressive behavior. I turned to stealing as we were poor. I fought a lot and I isolated from others. Rebellion became the norm for me, and adults, particularly my foster mom, my aunts, uncles, and teachers were my main targets. I didn't trust them in anything they told me, so I did the opposite. I was angry and resentful. School was a place where I felt disdain, particularly learning about the civil rights movements and the violence towards people of color. The inferior images the system placed upon black people for fighting for basic human rights upset me a lot. How does a 10-year-old deal with the scars of abandonment, unworthiness, and fear? How do you cope with that? For me, I connected with people who felt the same as I did, committed to protect one another, support one another, and ultimately raise each other, we became family. Societies labeled us as a gang. We took care of each other. Our means of surviving was to hustle. We stole from stores, sold drugs to get the things we wanted. We also used drugs and alcohol, and by age 14, I was placed in my first inpatient treatment. I completed that in 90 days and returned home. My performance was better in school. I was a good student when I applied myself. There were periods of praise and I excelled at sports, particularly basketball. Getting good grades and positive attention in sports gave me and my family great pride. This lasted for about 6 months, and at age 15, I was sent from Minneapolis to live with an aunt, my Aunt Sandy and my cousin Cassie here in Portland, Oregon. I was enrolled at Grant High School. Again, school improved, and I became a standout on the basketball team. In 1988, we won a state basketball championship. That was my junior year. I was receiving praise from colleges, getting many letters, even considered pretty highly ranked on the West Coast, as I was number 10 at that time. I was on the threshold of one of the greatest accomplishments in my life. 3 months later, I was arrested in Portland's first gang-related drive-by shooting that resulted in a death. I was remanded to adult court and eventually convicted of conspiracy to commit murder and sentenced to 20 years. How could a person with so much potential be involved in a situation where another person who looks just like them, after all the things we learned in school about how people looked at us, viewed us, commit a crime where this person lost his life? I did have a gun at the time and I did shoot. It was not my bullet, and for that I'm grateful. I stand here today in his memory and his honor, and for many people who have fallen due to the gang violence from all walks of life. During my incarceration, I went to substance abuse treatment, enrolled in barbering school, and got my GED. I also took college courses for a year. With six other inmates, I started an at-risk youth prevention program called DETOUR. It's an acronym that stands for Don't Take Our Unfortunate Route. Similar to Scare Straight, the difference is that we gave people a real look into the consequences of our behavior and decisions. I was also involved in the typical prison lifestyle. I continued to smoke marijuana, got into multiple fights, which landed me in solitary confinement, also known as the hole. I was living two lives. There's this version of me with low self-esteem and fear, wearing a mask of violence, drug abuse, and narcissism. Then there's another version of me living a life of compassion for others, empowering others, being loving and caring. In 1998, I was released after serving 10 years. I returned to live with my aunt, found a job, and met a woman and started a family. But life was dysfunctional for about 9 years. The two versions of myself were convoluted in my mind, and I continued to use drugs, which resulted in 5 more treatment attempts, followed by periods of success. Eventually, though, I returned to prison in 2006 for 3 years for a robbery. I was broken and I needed help. I wasn't eligible for any programs, so I attended 12-step meetings and read books. I was released in 2009 and returned back to that same dysfunctional family that I had created. At this time, I had 2 daughters, Jasmine, who is now 20, and Jermaisha, who is 17. I wanted to do good, and at times I did. I just couldn't sustain it. Eventually, I returned to using drugs. I was on parole and I was subjected to random urine analysis. My parole officer would give me parole violations for drug use, as well as hanging with known gang members. During one appointment with my PO, she offered to connect me with a mentor. I asked what a mentor is and what do they do. She said that mentors are people who used to be in the system, but are now productive members of society. She said he would help me find work, housing, and support me. I declined, and life continued to spiral downward. Something changed about 4 months later. I was using crack cocaine, marijuana, and alcohol for 3 days, and I could not get high. I could not escape the fact that I was a deadbeat dad, had thrown away a potential professional career as a basketball player, definitely a free education. I was desperate. I went to an appointment to see my PO and asked for help. She offered inpatient treatment at a county facility. I accepted. She also gave me 10 days for violation. I finished the violation and went directly into treatment from jail. I was relieved. I was applying myself in treatment. I began to challenge my belief system. During treatment, I looked at life honestly and took responsibility for my past decisions. Connected to that treatment was a mentor. We finally had an opportunity to talk. He told me how he had changed his life, how he used to be an outlaw, and I related to that story. I was inspired by how he changed. He told me that he believed in me and he wanted to help me achieve my goal of being a good father. He empowered me to seek the help that I was looking for. The credibility of the shared lived experience ushered me into action. I began dealing with my depression, dealing with my PTSD with a mental health counselor. I began to take mental health medication to help me cope with life. He helped me find employment and taught me how to face my past with humility. I had the support and guidance I was seeking all my life. There were many people that crossed my path during this time, up until that point in my life. Everyone always told me what they thought I should do. They told me that this is a way that you can change, or this is how you should live. This particular person asked me what I wanted to do. The most important part of communication for me is to listen. This person listened to me, and he supported me on my path. That was something I never had growing up. I eventually began working for the same organization as my mentor, who is now my supervisor. I started out as a house manager. This meant that not only did he believe in me and that I could change for the better, but I could support others who are also seeking to change as well. After a year of being a house manager, I was employed as a mentor for this same organization. I've been on that job for 5 years now, and I've had many different roles within the organization. My current role is being a mentor for the same treatment program or the last treatment program I went through. I have come full circle. You know, during this time, I've learned to be a father. My relationships with my 3 daughters and 1 son is great. I love them dearly. In fact, I now have my youngest son, my youngest daughter and son living with me. We recently just moved into a home as of Tuesday. As a formerly incarcerated person, I want to say that mentors play a very important role as change agents during the reentry process to society from incarceration. The guidance, support, accountability, and empowerment is key to the transition. Their knowledge about resources and different support groups are invaluable. Mentors are changing lives. I've been in recovery since 4/27 of 2010. My recovery is not limited. My recovery is not limited to the particular fellowship that I'm a part of. My recovery involves getting back into the community, advocating for others to be able to change, and hope to inspire. So with that, if there's someone who comes to mind as you hear our monologues, someone that is similar to us, I encourage you to listen to them. Guide them towards their goal and support their dream. I implore you to mentor them on their journey. Thank you.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. That was James's monologue, Healing the Split. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to Joseph and James for allowing me to feature your stories tonight. Thank you to all the participants of Shaping a Future, Life After Prison. We'll continue to broadcast this program on Prison Pipeline. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include 76 and the Footprints of Pan-Africanism and more at the Hollywood Theater, and The African Who Wanted to Fly, Foreign Bodies, Wulu, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm.